life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain.
Broadcasting from the Mayhem Moon, it's Dynamite in the Brain with your host Brian Smith and special guests Sublow and Tangy Mustard's Aaron Long.
Hello.
And Ace Comical's Leon Everett.
Hello.
Now I shall lean back towards the mic so I can now talk at a normal conversational level. I can't introduce at a normal conversational level. It doesn't have the right energy to it. Anyway, we're here today to talk about the 1986 Studio Ghibli film, Laputa, Castle in the Sky. And I don't know about you guys, I watched it on Netflix. Because over here we've got them all on Netflix. I don't know what they've got them where you are, Aaron.
Oh, I think they're on, or at least they're going to be, maybe they already are, on HBO Max, which I don't have. I have Netflix, but I just watched mine on an old Disney DVD,
gotcha.
Which I didn't realize until a little bit the way through it, that even though I was watching it in Japanese, it had the dub titles, which was a little bit of a disappointment. There are no proper subtitles on that copy.
Yeah, I don't know what the situation is on the Netflix.
I think on Netflix, the subs are for the Japanese.
Okay. I assume they were like the optimum release.
Yeah,
I think at this point they've sorted that out. But, you know, this version's from probably at least 15 years ago.
And what they say is, in this children's anime adventure, a young miner and a mysterious girl search for a long-lost island that's rumored to hold great riches. And this film is heartfelt, exciting, and feel-good. They say feel good pretty much about every single Ghibli film when you get through.
That's a surprisingly straightforward description for Netflix. They usually have some kind of weird, vague, cryptic quality to their descriptions that I guess to try and make you go like, what's this about? I guess I better watch it and find out.
Or it's just people whose job that is, as I'm a person who that has been their job, who've just got bored and are just... try to liven up their day. What they say on every single UK site where you might want to purchase the Blu-ray is, jumping overboard on a flying ship to avoid capture, Shita is rescued by her powerful crystal necklace, which floats her down to safety. Shita longs to see Laputa, the castle in the sky, but the pirates are after its treasure and its secret powers. As the different parties fight over who gets control of Laputa, it's up to Shita to use her ancient knowledge to save it from destruction. And as I said, this was released August the 2nd, 1986. And it was a twofer. As well as this, when you bought your ticket, you got to see Sherlock Hound 2, a compilation movie of the episodes Mrs. Hudson Hostage Case and Aerial Warfare in the Strait of Dover. I'm not sure I could take 3 hours of Ghibli animation or Ghibli-adjacent animation in the case of the Sherlock Hound episodes.
I was kind of thinking that, too, when I saw that. I mean, I know they did My Neighbor Totoro and Grave of the Fireflies as a double feature, which is also a questionable choice, I think.
I think it was Whiskey and Chaser with that.
Yeah, I think so.
Now
I don't know what order it was, though.
Now you're getting quiet, Leon. You've suddenly got
way,
quiet.
That's a strange order. This one, at least, I feel like tonally it would make sense, but yeah, it's just more than you'd probably want of this kind of adventuring in one dose.
And the tagline apparently is, "One day, a girl came down from the sky." I would say the Japanese Wikipedia for this movie is probably overly comprehensive in terms of like number of drawings. It goes into details of everything you could possibly need to know about the movie. And it's directed and written by Miyazaki, and our character designer animation director is Tsukasa Tanai from Lupin the Third Part 2, the second half of Sherlock Hound, and also the second half of Kochikame. I don't know why he gets to become the character designer animation director on second halves of things, but...
They bring him in as the fixer.
Yeah, quite possibly. I've only seen stuff from the first half of Catch a Cow Me, and it seemed perfectly fine, but maybe the second half amps itself up a bit.
It's interesting because the second half of Sherlock Hound is the part that Miyazaki didn't work on, I think.
Yeah, but maybe they just wanted somebody who could carry on the tone.
I guess so, yeah.
I've not seen much of that series. I've probably only seen that first episode we did for the dog episode, where we watched the first episodes of a whole bunch of dog anime.
I've seen a couple of episodes, and of course that just as popular spinoff or whatever, that Montana Jones or whatever.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Are you still there, Leon?
I am.
Okay, good. You're loud again now, so.
Good loud.
Good loud, yes.
yeah.
And the cast is Sheeta. Is it supposed to be Theta? I was looking that apparently the name comes from a puppet show that Miyazaki did in university or as a student. I'm not sure it was necessarily university, called Sine Cosine Theta, which would make more sense than Sheeta.
Maybe interesting.
Just a bit of transliteration.
I do know that the names got kind of corrupted from reading the, what's his name, Steve Alpert. He was like involved in translating Ghibli movies into English. And he said that there was this kind of like, you know, the names started as real names in a certain language, and then they got translated into Chinese, I think, and then into Japanese. So they're based on real names somewhere, but they ended up just sort of being gibberish.
So that's our heroine, and she's played by Keiko Yokozawa, the voice of Doraemon's sister, Dorami. I don't think I've seen a decent amount of Doraemon now. I say a decent amount. There's so much of it, it's a drop in the ocean. but I don't think I've seen anything with any of the related cat robots in it.
Yeah, me neither.
And then our hero is Pazu, played by Mayumi Tanaka, who sounds exactly the same in 1986 as she does today. The voice of Krillin and Monkey D. Luffy. And the quiz was going to be, can you guess the Mayumi Tanaka character? Are they a teenage boy or a woman? But I think there's only about three women I could have used in that quiz.
She does have a perfect voice for teenage boys.
And then the rest of the cast is rendered out by more like theatre and screen actors. Dola is played by Katoe Hatsue, who apparently was well known for playing old ladies. Uncle Pom is played by Fujio Takita, and Muska is played by Minori Terada. Coincidentally, they are both in Zatoichi versus Yojimbo. I can't imagine that's why they're both cast in this, because they've got many, many other screen credits to their name.
And they don't even appear together, right?
No, they don't, no. So it would be I'm assuming it's just a weird coincidence, not that Miyazaki is a big fan of that film and demanded both of them to be in this.
He was just, when they were casting, he just kept asking for characters from that movie.
So before we get into the film itself, is this the first time you've seen it, or when was the first time you've seen it? Aaron, start with you.
I've seen it a few times. I don't know. This is probably my fourth viewing or something, at least, I guess. I first saw it sometime in the mid 2000s when I was discovering Ghibli and going through all their stuff. And as I said, I've only ever seen it on that old Disney DVD copy.
How about yourself, Leon?
Pretty much exactly the same. So I think the first time I saw it is when the Disney must have put out the DVDs in the aughts. And since then, I think I've watched it about the same times. I think this was maybe my fourth or fifth time as well.
As I mentioned on the podcast before, I saw the end of this movie in 1996. At Minamicon 2. And it turns out, watching it in full for the first time today, I've seen 5 minutes of this before. I've seen the last. I'd only seen the last 5 minutes. I could have sworn I'd seen more of it. But apparently that would make sense, I think, the last 5 minutes. I was probably just going in. Maybe it was overrunning for the thing I actually wanted to see, which was probably some sort of trashy OVA or something.
It seemed like it was taking longer.
Yeah, it was probably, given that period of time, it was probably something Rubiko Takahashi based. I think it might have been a Yurusei Asura OVA.
That's not trashy. Well, maybe, depending on...
They're not great, those OVAs.
Yeah. They're a mixed bag for sure.
So was it at the Minami? I assume it was subbed and not the like old dub.
I think it would have been a fan sub, yeah, at that point in time. And this was the final year Minami was in Portsmouth, because it was in Portsmouth for the first 2 years, and then it's been in the same hotel in Southampton ever since.
I didn't even know there was an older dub of this. Streamliners?
I think it is.
One of those dubs where they renamed them like Pazu and Cheeto or like Bob and Sally or something?
I can't remember. And I'm surprised I've not seen that either, because
I think it's meant to be bad. But not that bad, maybe.
More accurate to the Japanese.
Yeah, but they did used to show those on Sky in like the late 90s, early 2000s, those batch of dubs. So I'd seen the Totoro. And what was the other one? But yeah, this one had eluded me. Bertha Green and Louise Chambel are the...
Whoa. Those are their names, isn't it?
Well, hang on. Are these the character names? No, they're not. No, what they are is... these are the fake names the actors are using because it's a non-union job.
Yeah. Of course.
It doesn't mention that they were using different names. Yeah, I suddenly realised that the same names were appearing further down the list because obviously they were just getting people to double up on roles.
Oh, yeah.
I see the English dub from Disney's James Van Der Beek and Anna Paquin.
Yeah, he doesn't sound like a kid.
No.
Neither does she.
That would be the thing.
They both sound like they're...
That was the thing putting me off switching over to the dub, because I was like, Clarice Leachman as Captain Dola. I was like, that's tempting.
Because I did start it on the dub this time, because I thought, let me try it out, because I don't remember watching the dub before, and I made it like maybe 15 minutes, and like I like Anna Paquin as an actress, but I don't know what accent she was trying to do.
Yeah, it's very inconsistent.
It's awful. I had to change back.
Mark Hamill is this the one where Mark Hamill plays the villain?
He does.
I didn't make it. I didn't get to him showing up on screen by the time I changed.
He's pretty good. The thing that bugged me, because I had it auto playing on the dub as well, and before there was even any dialogue, I was like, I'd better switch this, because I saw that they've added so much music in the Disney version. To just make sure it's like really explicit what you're supposed to be feeling at every moment. And I remember thinking it was cool that the beginning of this movie starts with just a lot of sound effects rather than any kind of music to establish the mood. But, you know, immediately there's some sweet little song playing at the beginning. And I was like, nope, back to the Japanese.
Did you enjoy? I assume you must enjoy this film if you've watched it four times and wanted to come on a podcast. But I will check in that you're not just hate watching it.
Yeah, I like it a lot. Yeah, I think it's probably one of my favorite Ghiblis. I mean, it's hard to say that because they all, you know, kind of whichever one you're watching, you're like, oh, this one's pretty good. But I'd say this and Porco Rosso, maybe Whisper of the Heart. But I also like Kiki and Nausicaa. I don't know. It's impossible to say that, but. I do like it a lot, yeah.
How about yourself, Leon?
No, I'm a big masochist. I just love to sit through two-hour animations I can't stand. I think I have a special fondness for the earlier Ghibli movies.
Yeah, me too.
Especially the like sort of pre-Ghibli ones like Nausicaa and Lupin the Third. or Castle of Cagliostro. Like, just in the texture of, like, the animation, the looks, the sounds, I have, like, maybe it's not a nostalgia or something, but there's just a nice atmosphere those movies give me, so it's always nice to return to them. And I think with this movie in particular, it's maybe one of my favorites. But I think part of that is because of what it seemingly feels like it's influenced so many things after it.
Yeah. Watching it this time, I was thinking, wow, that I've never seen much of it. That Nadia show, Nadia Secret of Blue Water, just seems like a shameless ripoff of Castle in the Sky.
Well, yeah, I was looking into that. But again, take it with a pinch of salt, because I was looking into it through a machine-translated Wikipedia page. But Anno did say that, like, some of the stuff in this is Miyazaki's pitch for a Future Boy Conan 2.
Oh, interesting.
And that the stuff that he didn't end up using, Anno took for himself to use in Nadia's Secret of Blue Water. But
wow.
That I may be terribly misrepresenting by paraphrasing stuff I'm reading. That's poorly translated. But yeah, there definitely is a connection between the two. Oh yeah, and the other thing I saw was Pazuzu's name apparently is the one name of a bunch of sailors that Miyazaki had thought up when he was a child that he hadn't used already in Future Boy Conan.
Another thing I heard about behind the scenes of this film is that apparently, and partly the reason that Studio Ghibli ended up being created is because Isao Takahata had been shooting this. Have you heard about this Yanagawa Canals documentary?
Yeah, I think I was reading a little bit about this, yeah, but not the actual details of what the thing was that he was making.
So it's this, like, I think 3-hour documentary. I've started watching it, I haven't finished it, about just this canals in this town of Yanagawa that he said he was going there initially to scout locations for an animated film. And then he ended up spending like 3 years there shooting like this insane amount of footage for this documentary. And he went so far over the budget that he'd been allotted that he came to Miyazaki and said, you have to make another animated film like immediately to pay back all the costs of this. Which is why they started Studio Ghibli and made Castle in the Sky, I think.
Yeah, that was...
Because at the time,
I picked that bit
Miyazaki
up.
Did not want to do another film. He was kind of burnt out from doing Nausicaa.
Yeah.
He said he'd lost all his friends from doing that. He was like, I never want to make another film. And then he almost immediately had to go into production, or into at least pre-production on this.
Yeah, and then this is the first one and also the worst performing Ghibli film until the release of The Red Turtle.
That was surprising to me. This, I know Kiki was their first big hit, but I would have thought that this would be more successful.
Yeah,
it seems like such a crowd pleaser.
That's the thing. It did please everybody who showed up for it. And that's why they got to continue to make films, was it had a very positive reaction from the audiences who did see it. But yeah, it was apparently beaten by like the Toei manga Matsuri, the Dorimon film, and then something called Animal Films. So I don't know whether they were just releasing animal documentaries regularly in the 80s, that's a thing I've missed out on, or whether it was those Disney animal documentaries would get released in Japan.
Maybe yeah. If they hadn't done the double feature with episodes of a TV show, it wouldn't have kept people away.
Yeah, maybe it was just too much cartoons. Because those Toei manga Matsuri's run similarly length, but at least you're getting half cartoons, half live action people in costumes.
And it's not all one guy's cartoons.
Yes, that's true as well, yeah.
It's not 3 hours of just like Akira Toriyama or something.
Yeah, so the things it was up against, the thing, other notable Japanese film cartoons out that year in the movies were Project Aiko, They Were 11, Arion, and Urusei Yatsura: Alum the Forever.
That's the fourth one, right?
Yes.
The weirdest one.
Yeah, I've still not got around to watching it, because if it's not Oshi, I've got no get up and go to go and watch it.
Yeah, that's understandable.
So my first impressions of this is I really liked it until they got to Laputa, and then I was like, I don't like it as much as when they were trying to get to Laputa, which I think might just be a problem with these sorts of stories that I have. Because I was like, maybe I think that's why I don't like the Indiana Jones films that much. For a very similar reason.
You're all about the journey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like a chase. Mm-hmm. I was like, because it's got a lot of the Lupin type action at the start, with the slapstick and the like, the people falling over each other, and the stuff with the sons. I don't know if they're literally all her sons, or
I want to think they are.
It's just those three are. I couldn't quite figure out exactly how their outfit was. It seems like they've got ground crew and also the people on the Tiger Moth. Yeah, so all that stuff I was greatly enjoying. And then it was like, oh, and I get to the end. It's like, okay, right. This is the sort of thing that somebody making this cartoon in 1986 would put in their cartoon. It's like, and I think I'd have loved it in 1986, but, because I was probably not quite the target audience in 86. I was probably a little older than the target audience. But I would have probably eaten it up then. And certainly everyone in my class would, because I remember all people having loads of UFO books and ancient civilization type stories, all that Eric Van Daniken stuff, still being drawn. I mean, it's obviously still being drawn on today with all that ancient alien nonsense. But yeah, when he gets in his flying doomsday weapon and says, this was the doomsday weapon that this culture thought was something and this culture thought was something else. I was like, yeah, this is very 1986. I can still see that line of books that everyone in my class used to bring in when they weren't reading gore, of all things. It's like, goodness knows what those kids have grown up into. But
I'd agree, though, yeah, about the first half being more fun. It's got so much momentum and energy to it. Miyazaki's so good at doing chases like that, like sort of slapstick chases, and there's like tension coming from like the limitations of the vehicles, like, you know, all the mechanics of the trains or like the flying machines and stuff. He's so good at that stuff. And then, yeah, once you get there, in a physical sense, the momentum literally dies because they're just running around in circles on the castle in the sky.
Yeah, they literally tie up the most fun characters in the film.
Right. Yeah.
As if to say,
Phil and her gang kind of remind me of Miyazaki's version of the Lupin gang, just in how much they seem to enjoy everything they're doing as thieves, you know.
Yeah,
like even when they're running from no matter like what they're doing, they always have these big grins on their faces.
Yeah, to me they reminded me a bit of Mar Beagle and the Beagle Boys from the Karl Barks Duck books, and then of course DuckTales.
Oh yeah,
particularly of just like having the three like different sized sons who are all useless at doing their job. It's so much fun, and I forget how much I like slapstick and physical comedy, and I have to remind myself I have twice bought tickets to see what are literally mime performances. It's like
Blue Man Group.
There was a British guy called Les Bub, who was probably the most. He would appear on TV doing comedy stuff, but his actual full-length show was like a mime about the environment for about an hour and a half.
Whoa.
Yeah, I think it was a bit more serious than I expected. And then more recently, I went to see the Japanese group Ciro A, who've been on America's Got Talent. I think they did quite well on that. Yeah, so let's get into the story. For those people who've not seen it, we're going to completely ruin it for you now. So we opened with air pirates attacking an airship. I was like, excellent. Good pulpy stuff. Like the air pirates in Porco Rosso, but this one appears to be less tethered to reality in terms of like the design of the ships, which are like they're all like insect themed, aren't they, that the air pirates have got.
Yeah, and they're so cool. I love those little ships.
And they're attacking this airship to get at this young girl who's on board, but she uses this opportunity to escape a man guarding her on the airship. So clearly she's not on board the airship of her own accord. And this all results in her trying to escape the pirates and the people holding her hostage and her falling off the airship. It's an absolute...
That moment gets...
Yeah, it's a cracking... It's a cracking start. Yes, you're right. Yeah, carry on, Aaron.
Oh, just every time she falls, that sends like a shiver down my spine. It's like when Lupin gets shot in Cagliostro. I'm just going like, what? No, that couldn't have happened. It's just so abrupt. Something about how fast it happens.
Yeah, she falls off the airship, and then we go into the opening. We get the reactions of the reactions of the pirates. So you know, like these pirates aren't so bad. It's like their reaction is both concern for the girl and the thing they're trying to steal off the girl, which is her necklace. And then we get the opening, which seems to be like a tale of both, like a visual tale of like the development of these airships in this world and the mining community that the girl ends up falling into. She falls off this airship into Wales.
Yeah.
Where she meets a similarly aged young boy called Parzu. And he takes her into his house, and he's like making the connection, and he's talking about how his father had once taken a photo of this mysterious floating island, Laputa, and his father was certain that the island existed, and so they're both orphans, they're kind of living... had both been living in their parents' homes that had left them in various parts of this country, which it's weird. It's both, it feels like a fantasy world, and yet later it's clearly not a fantasy world because they reference real world things. And there's a date on the photo, I think, of like 1869 or something along those lines. So you're guessing this is
right.
Late 19th century that this is taking place in. Just a slightly different one to the one we might be familiar with.
Yeah, it's almost a little bit steampunky. A little bit.
It is, but I hate the phrase steampunk, so I'm trying to avoid saying it at all times.
Fair enough. Feel free to edit that out.
That's fine. But no, if you were the sort of person who liked to say things were steampunk, it's certainly a steampunk. less top hats. In fact, I think the only top hats are in the next sequence of when the sons arrive in town searching for Sheeta, the girl who's fallen out of the sky. And I guess their idea of being incognito is to dress up in white dinner suits with top hats and wander around town. Like, no one will suspect that we're air pirates if we dress up smartly.
Totally inconspicuous.
Yeah, walk through a mining town looking for a young girl. I think it's the point where they're asking Pazu's... it's not that... What relationship are those two to him? Are they just like... They've just been looking after him, I guess?
It seems like it. They're just kind of, you know, the whole, like, it takes a village to raise the kid or whatever. Everybody's kind of fond of this kid, I think.
Yeah, because it seems like where he employs him, he has, like, a sort of some sort of guardian thing, maybe?
Yeah. But Pazu is, like, one of many who seem to work there, right?
Yeah.
If I'm remembering correctly.
But yeah, when they go up to him and they like take them into the house and tell them to run out the back door while they talk to these pirates, I was like, the youngest one and the big burly one with the beard are just Lupin wearing disguises. Their character designs are. I did like the burly off that the guy from the town and the burly pirate have of just flexing their muscles to rip their shirts off.
That's great. It's one of the best parts of the movie, I think, yeah. It's a little bit Popeye-ish.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
I also like at the end of it, after he rips his shirt to show how tough he is, the lady says, I'm not going to fix that for you.
Yeah, I think on our subtitles it's, and who's going to sew that shirt back up?
Yeah.
So they make the escape on the train out of town, and we get like a train versus automobile chase as the pirates hop onto their mum's car and chase after them. And this leads them to escaping by falling down a mine. We'd had earlier, Pazzu had tried to like use the gem himself, and he couldn't. He just fell through the roof of his house.
Oh yeah, that's great.
But yeah, falling down the mine, she's able to use the stone, and they safely land at the bottom of the mine. And on their way out,
this is after that train chase, right?
It is, yeah.
I love that train chase; it's so good. It's kind of similar to one that Miyazaki did in one of the Green Jacket Lupin the Third episodes. Towards the end of that series, there's an episode where Lupin and this girl are being chased by gangsters, and I think he uses some of the same gags a little bit in there.
And
I just really like trains.
Of course you do. Yes, I should always remember that about you.
Yeah, you know. But, yeah.
And they run into Uncle Pom, who does he just live underground? Is that his deal?
It seems like it.
Yeah.
He seems to just kind of randomly be down there. It's not like he's working or anything.
It's a nice quiet spot away from everybody else.
Yeah. And yeah, he's talking about the crystals in the mine, and then they start reacting to the stone, and he sees the stone, and he comes over all Gollum-ish and has to tell them to put the stone away because it's too tempting for him. But he helps them get out of the mine, and then they're immediately captured by Muska and taken to his castle, which is not in the sky. We've not got to that castle yet. We're in his castle, where he's...
Castle on the ground.
Castle on the ground. I don't know what exactly his position is. He's got these guys in black who seem to work directly for him, and he's got the military involved with this Goliath battleship, but he's manipulating the military as well, as we see later when he starts cutting the phone lines and taking over command.
While we're talking about him, I want to say Miyazaki always gets a lot of praise for not having villains, you know, that everybody's sort of shades of gray if they're a bad guy, but he's about as close to a pure villain as you could get.
Yeah, he's a complete villain. Yeah.
No redeeming factors with this guy at all.
he's a total pulp villain, particularly by the end. And I was like, Jess Nevins does have his encyclopedia back up online, but it's harder to search than it used to be, because I was like, I know that in his encyclopedia of pulp characters, there's one who's almost exactly like how he's behaving at the end, of like, I'm a super science villain and I've got this flying battleship, and I'm going to destroy you, hold your country's hostage, which is exactly what he's doing. He's missing a mustache to twirl, but even his undoing,
which is rare for Miyazaki villains.
That's true. Yes,
Miyazaki loves an evil mustache.
And they end up letting, but it's gone out of my mind. I'm thinking mustaches. Pazzu go. They pay him off, send him on his way, and Sheeta, like, he's trying to like save him by telling him to do this, but he's having none of this. He gets back home, finds the Sky Pirates eating all his food, making a mess of his house, and he's going to join them Because they're like, oh, we only want the stone. So he's like, can I come with you to rescue her as well?
I think Peter Jackson stole this for that scene in The Hobbit. when Bilbo or whatever comes back and finds them all eating his food.
They didn't sing any songs. Like
oh, yeah, that's right. Seems like they were about to before he broke in, though.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, they're trying to get her to wake up this robot they've got. Apparently this fell off Laputa, and this is Muska's evidence that Laputa exists, is this partially broken robot. And unfortunately for him, they do manage to get the robot to wake up, and it kind of goes a bit King Kong as it fights its way up to find Sheeta and then carry her to the roof of a tower and protect her from the oncoming enemies. And this is where he hijacks like the military communications to get them to open fire on the robot. And I was like, oh, have I seen this scene? And I was like, I don't know if I've seen this scene or have I seen parodies of this scene or whether I've just seen models recreating this scene. It's like particularly
from Ghibli merch, you mean?
Yeah, it's particularly like the pose when he's protecting her. I was like, ah, that seems super familiar to me. Maybe it's just a model kit. I know there are some model kits for this that would show up in UK model shops, along with the various Lupin Cagliostro kits. And then we get the rescue.
I remember.
Yeah, go on.
About the robot, everybody always describes it as being a ripoff of the one from that 40s Fleischer Superman cartoon.
Yes.
So I was just looking up a picture, and it's not actually that close.
It's not that close, but its behavior is quite similar. Mm-hmm. It's the arms turning into wings, I think.
I guess, specifically,
the bit. But it also resembles an earwig and various other insects. Not at this point.
So I definitely heard that it was... I definitely see the similarity, but I hadn't looked at that in a long time, and I was kind of thinking like, oh, Miyazaki just stole it directly from that. But the iconic design, I think, is unique to this version.
It is, yeah.
With the arms being however designed, you know, the weird design of the arms.
Yeah, it's very, it's got like segmented, it's got a segmented body, but to its arms mm-hmm. and its legs. And when we see them later off, later on in their like hibernation pose, they kind of look more like earwigs.
Yeah. And it's also the same robot that he used in that final Lupin Part 2 episode, right?
Again, I'm a good boy and I haven't eaten the most delicious food yet on those Lupin episodes. And I've not got
that. Have you seen the other one he did, the albatross one?
I think I've seen one of these again at a convention, possibly without subtitles. Because
they're both pretty good.
They were definitely
the
sort of things
one better.
People would put into convention schedules in the 90s. Yeah. It's like, here's some Miyazaki you've not seen before, lads. Yeah, and they basically... it's Pazu and Dola are the ones who rescue her. Okay, it takes them a few attempts. They have to do basically a trapeze act to rescue her in the end. Also, it's not helped by the biggest bit of peril is when Dola gets knocked out.
They're doing that sort of vertical climb, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, and he has to regain controls, but luckily she wakes up and everything gets sorted. And then they're on board the Tiger Moth, where we meet Dola's husband, who has not, I don't think, has been mentioned at all until they're bringing them on board. Who looks like a bit like Wilford Brimley.
Yes.
I'll have to add him to my list of anime Wilford Brimleys for... whenever conventions come back, that's a planned possible panel.
Isn't there a thing in it too where he's not all their father, right?
No,
doesn't he? At first, I assumed that they were married and they're all the kids. But doesn't he make some reference to like being in love with her, but that she doesn't like him or something?
I can't remember. I do know that I was getting the vibe. And this is because Pazu's there and he's got Luffy's voice of the character Big Mom currently in One Piece, who has many, many children and doesn't like her husbands. to the point where I was like, did he just write that character in because he was a Laputa fan? And hey, if you've got Pazu's voice as your main character, you might as well do that. Also, it's like the thing of Dola's character is like very much like this old lady, but she's got like a child's sense of selfishness and a child's energy, which is also very similar to the character of Big Mom. And I was like, I guess this is just super influential, and I wouldn't put it past him just writing that in because he would be 11 years old when this came out.
I'm looking at Big Mom right now. She's a great design.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
It's a hilarious drawing.
And she's like, she lives in like a 1920s cartoon world where everything has faces and dances. Probably more, strictly speaking, 1930s, because they also sing. So we get like they've got to earn their keep by doing various jobs. And then we get the scene, which was like, of course, yes, this always the sense that Miyazaki is a bit of a creep. When all the air pirates come to creep on Shita.
Oh, yeah, that is a little uncomfortable.
I was like, okay. I mean, the punchline.
They're asking her to marry them, is that right?
It's because there's like a throwaway line of like, I can't remember who makes the line, but it's like, oh, she'll grow up to be like their mum. That's the sort of girl you want to marry.
I think she says that herself. And then later on they parrot it saying like, I can't believe she's going to grow up to be like mum. And it's just like, Oedipal as well. Like, this is weird.
Yeah.
But the punchline of them ended up doing all her chores for her is a decent punchline now, whether it's worth the general creepiness.
I mean, maybe you could be super charitable and say they were just really hungry.
That's true. But it's the fact that she becomes more attractive to them once she starts wearing their mother's trousers.
Yeah. That is strange.
I guess when you learn that the Dola's based on Miyazaki's mother as well.
Whoa. There's a lot of layers here.
See, this is why they had Dawson and Rogue playing them older, because
that could actually be, yeah.
They want to de-creep the audience in the West.
But thankfully, before it could get too creepy, we have an airship fight, but not before Dola's overheard a conversation they were having in the lookout spot about is it a spell of destruction that her grandmother had taught her, because you have to learn the destructive spells as well as the beneficial spells to give the beneficial spells power. I don't think you really get into much of the other magic beyond activating a robot and then that destruction spell at the end.
Yeah, it's like, what are the good spells?
Yeah,
maybe. I guess the whole magic castle floating in the sky is kind of could be considered one of the good spells.
Maybe there was like a making plants grow and making robots abandon war and protect little birds instead.
That's pretty good.
I do like that sequence where they're up in the bird's nest and she's just listening, because I feel like a lot of other similar setups to that type of scene would be a thing of like, I overheard the thing and I'm going to double cross you. And instead it's more like character stuff for her, sat in her bed listening.
Yeah. It's not like a sinister thing necessarily. Yeah.
No.
And it sort of sets up and pays off some character stuff later on, so that she knows that they're doing the destruction spell and stuff. So I did quite like how that was all like conceived and set up.
Yeah, because it makes her closer to them by overhearing that rather than pushing her further away from them.
Yeah.
And then they get into an airship fight and they end up on like a glider which gets them onto Laputa, where they run into a morph.
They go through like an electrical storm or something, right?
Yeah, I can't remember. This was kind of where I was beginning to lose my interest, I have to say.
there's a lot of moving parts during all that, because it's the bird's nest itself that can transform into the glider, and include a bit about like phone system that we're using, like the cups on wires, is not going to work anymore, but we have a radio. Yep, we know how to use the radio. And then it's like, and then you just wind these things. It feels, not in a bad way, but it does feel very sort of procedural video game-ish, where it's like you need to do the stuff. Yeah.
They end up with a friendlier robot, and they see lots of weird animals, including the fox squirrel from Nausicaa, has a whole bunch of them scampering on around the robot. But this does not do them all that much good, because they end up getting captured by Mooska again. He double crosses everybody, finds the crystal, and finally gets to turn fully into a pulp novel villain while the military are like ripping all the gold off the off the city. Probably the most accurate portrayal of the military.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what this reminds me of? This part where that once they finally get to the... I mean, we said this earlier, that a lot of these stories, the journey is the more exciting part, but I was watching Yellow Submarine not too long ago, and it's definitely got the same thing where, you know, they finally get to Pepperland or whatever, and that, and you go, okay, this feels like it should be the end. The fun part's over now that they've arrived. And then you go, wait a minute, there's still at least a third of the movie left. What else is going to happen?
People are going to point guns at each other. Well, in this, at least.
A lot of standoffs and stuff.
I will say I do like... I may need to get a new microphone. or a new voice. I'm just peaking too loud. I do like his like frustration of the overgrowth of the roots through everything. Like in his head, he was expecting it to be like pristine as his ancestors had left it for him. Which doesn't in no way makes him sympathetic, but it's a foible where his coolness slips.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good detail for sure.
Makes him a little petulant.
Yeah.
And it kind of ties in with everything that she ends up saying about how you have to love nature and the balance of everything. And, you know, the fact that he doesn't like all the nature that's grown in there helps with that.
Yeah, obviously you've got the thing of you now can't see him without thinking of like other Miyazaki stories about the environment. Obviously Nausicaa had that as well, as the recurring trope. But yeah, he gets control because he's also a member of the royal family, just like Sheeta was, and they can go into the secret room with the crystal, and he's been studying the ancient language, and so he knows how to operate it, and he can switch on the pylons to shoot electricity out. And also,
sounds a little familiar to Count of Cagliostro, right?
Yeah, I guess
Miyazaki's
it is.
Miyazaki's never above reusing an idea.
Exactly. And he can project holograms, and he's just a total pulp novel villain. But Pazuzu has rescued, well, he's freed the pirates. Dola's given him a gun to go and rescue Sheeta, and then a whole lot of luck gets him to where she is, because really, I don't think how how he'd do it without the look that he has when the military open fire on Lapiter and the impact of the blast blows him up it's a torpedo tube for firing out robots.
Yeah, he does a lot of big just leaps of logic where he just happens to be in the perfect spot.
And he gets in front of Muska and he ends up with the stone because she gives it to him through a narrow gap. This was like where I was like, oh, all these like struggling noises I'm very familiar with from watching so many episodes of One Piece, because I was like, not sure there's anybody better with doing like a teenage boy in having to relay a physical like struggle.
Exerting himself. Yeah. Yeah. There's a moment there I thought was pretty funny. I think this is the same spot where there's the explosion under the ground and it kind of looks like Dola's just farted.
Oh, yes.
Right? Is that the same moment? Yeah.
It is.
And then Pazu pulls away more bricks, sticks his face into her crotch, basically. And they talk for a little bit. And then when he leaves and he goes back down, she says, "The boy has become a man." Which I know there's more going on in the scene than just that, but just his face in her crotch and then "the boy's become a man" made me laugh.
Yeah, it was, it is a joke. But yes, the what she was actually referring to was the fact that she'd shaken out a massive gun from down her stockings. and so he basically gets Muska's, like, just give us a few minutes to talk this over and then we'll tell you in silence. So
let's hatch some plots for 3 minutes.
Yeah. There's a really awkward shot of him walking halfway across the room, which I was like, I'm not sure this adds anything.
That's like the classic Filmation shot where it's just a walk cycle of a character going from left to right across the screen.
And they do this, he's like, "Teach me the spell of destruction." And she does, which is very easy to learn because it's a single word. And so they cast it and they blow the whole place up. And the bright light which shines when they cast it blinds Muska. And he does a Velma Dinkley before falling to his death. which is, I guess, it feels like a very pulp novel villain way to die. Of like, the heroes don't actually have to kill him themselves; they just inflict a wound which leads him to his own death.
It's a little bit guilt free. So the heroes don't become murderers, but the villain still dies.
The pirates are on their what they're called, the flittering things. I can't even if they give a name for it in the movie. I know they've got a name on the model kits and all that jazz. The tiger moth goes down though, much to the dad's dismay. But they're like, "Oh no, the kids!" And then they see that the actual island itself hasn't been destroyed; just the weapon of mass destruction. And the crystal is still glowing and sending Lapiter ever skyward. And the kids have survived. The roots saved them. And hey, look, the glider's here. We can get away.
And what's left from the castle, basically, is just the castle itself and a bunch of roots, right? The island has sort of fallen away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
It was all just dirt anyway, I guess.
And just going further into orbit. As we see over the credits, as everyone gets their happy ending, apart from Muska, who didn't deserve it, and I guess the general who fell to his doom when Muska removed the floor from beneath him earlier.
Oh yeah, Muska gets rid of. He just kind of abandons his whole, like all the soldiers and people working for him, right?
He does.
At a certain point, he just goes, "Well, I don't need them anymore. I got the robots now."
Yeah, even the men in black. He's like, "You wait outside this door. You're not allowed in here."
Yeah.
And Miyazaki never wrote a villain.
it's an enjoyable film. It's definitely not my least favorite Ghibli film. There's at least two which come to mind that I'd run and avoid rather than watch again. Princess Mononoke and Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh yeah, I think I'm definitely with you on Howl's Moving Castle. I think I I always feel like Princess Mononoke is good, but I don't enjoy it that much.
Yeah.
I could definitely, you know, I feel like it's a powerful film, but I don't know. I'm not that into it myself either, yeah.
There's still a whole load of blank spots for me, but this was obviously a fairly big one, and it's no longer blank. I think I'd probably watch segments of it again, rather than the
first
entire
half.
Film. Yeah, the first half, particularly like the everything before the opening credits is
yeah.
That's basically just a great short in and of itself.
Definitely, yeah.
Any other thoughts, guys?
Continue.
I was going to say, I've seen people complain, like, as a criticism of this film, that it's sort of just a recycling of older Miyazaki ideas, like, mainly it's just sort of Future Boy Conan stuff, which makes sense if you were saying it was planned as a sequel. But also, you know, there's a lot of the same kind of shenanigans that you get to with, like, Lupin and Castle of Cagliostro and all that. But I have never seen Future Boy Conan, so that's not a problem for me.
Go ahead, Leon.
Just a few things, though, like an ad or just re-loop. I also appreciate a very nice train sequence. and so if you're going to have airships and trains in your movie, that is enough to sort of cement over some of the things that don't work as well. I always forget every time I watch this movie that there's quite a body count in it, that I feel quite refreshing every time I go back. Like, there's such a consistent level of threat that whenever, especially at the end where it's just constant death. He has like a nuclear test. It's like, look at, let me do a test of how this weapon works. And we don't know who was down there. And I love how dynamic the sort of set pieces and action are throughout the film. And yeah, despite it being quite long for animation, at 2 hours and 4 minutes or so, for the most part, especially before the last third, it does seem to move in a way that is not just plot heavy, but you do spend time with characters. And I think because of that, it's very good at evoking what this world is, even if it doesn't really explicitly tell us what the what the history is, or what the dynamics are between all the different people. But
there's not a lot of detailed world building, but you definitely come away with it from it. You come away from it feeling like you kind of understand the world.
Yeah, and I think it is because it does rely on a lot of, say, archetypal stuff. And as you guys have said, it does seem to have been if we're charitable, it's a refinement maybe of some of these ideas that have come back. And I think one of the things that gets me, especially got me on this turn, is like what I was saying right at the start in terms of just the influences. I cannot not feel like Final Fantasy VI or Breath of the Wild, especially when they get to Laputa. The music even feels Breath of the Wild, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild-ish. And it's it is wild to think that this film and the various elements inside it influenced a lot of things, which ended up being very influential worldwide in the West. Even to the level of, Skies of Arcadia on the Dreamcast. There's a very sort of 16-bit era to maybe to 32-bit era JRPG vibe to the whole film. And I think that's what gives me a little bit of a nostalgia hit whenever I watch it. And like I was saying earlier, with one of the elements almost feeling tutorialized video game. It definitely feels like this could have been the adaptation of a 16-bit JRPG that came out.
I could see that, yeah.
though I guess when this came out, it was during the NES, it would have been 8-bit. But yeah, it definitely feels like it's laid like quite a impressionable template where instead of things that are inspired by, say, the things that are featured in there, like airships, which have been around for centuries, blah, blah, it feels like instead a lot of the influences came from this movie instead. Like how when it comes to cyberpunk stuff, people just go, they just go to Blade Runner and stop instead of going back further. It does kind of feel like that.
I know what you mean.
But like in this situation, it's all stuff that I like. So I think that's why I have warm feelings over it. Even though if you were to ask me, say like my favorite Studio Ghibli films, I wouldn't think to say this, like if I was reading out a top five. But then rewatching it, while it doesn't fully stick the landing in it always, I did have quite a fun time watching it.
Yeah. I think one of the things that maybe, like, for me, doesn't make it always come to mind first is that the characters aren't that, like, they're totally fine for the story, but Pazu and Shida aren't as memorable as, like, Nausicaa or Kiki or Totoro, you know, or a lot of other Miyazaki characters.
Yeah, I think you nailed it with that. They are kind of, not bland, but they are kind of...
They just fulfill their role in the story, sort of. Yeah.
They're very sort of everyman-ish, where it's like he's the everyman boy who gets caught up in adventure, and she's the everyman or everywoman girl who's like, who's a secret princess who's been kidnapped.
Yeah, they're such archetypes.
Yeah, so the point, yeah.
Dola's the most memorable character, for sure, I think.
Yeah. To the point where, Nadia is very much just those they just give it a little bit more time, but they are pretty much almost, you can map the characters on very consistently to these ones.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Boy, oh boy, you can. I guess the Captain Nemo is probably the thing which throws it slightly different.
I guess so, yeah.
But beyond that, yeah, it's very similar. And also, like, the pirates aren't the same sort of pirates. They're the guys from Time Bokan rather than just these pirates. They've stolen those guys from the classic trio of the woman, the big guy, and the skinny guy. So the other thing I wanted to ask was, as he based this on an idea from primary school, what would films based on our primary school ideas look like if we or were you thinking of Sublo and Taggy Mustard, Aaron, that far back?
I had some stupid ideas for characters that were basically just me and my sister doing all the same stuff that we do in real life, but for some reason there was one element that was totally fantasy, which was that they lived in this giant, this really skinny building on wheels that could then like compress down into just being like a square car. Maybe I'd do something with that if I was going to do a movie based on an idea from primary school, because everything else was just basically slice of life. Just I had a baseball practice I had to go to, so the characters had to go to baseball practices and stuff. House that can turn into a car.
Leon, can you?
I think my stuff, especially like late secondary school, late primary school, early secondary school, a lot of my stuff was, I feel like it's been ripped off already by Hollywood. Like it was a lot of, like silly stuff, because my stuff was like, because I'd been watching anime in the mid-90s and stuff, and was a big like video gamer in that time. It was a lot
The Matrix.
Like elements, I think, but only because The Matrix was inspired by the same stuff that I had been watching. But like, yeah, bits and pieces of things like Matrix-y type like action, but like basically like Hong Kong style fighting, but in the West. Stuff to do with like I think I basically created Tomb Raider before Tomb Raider came out as well. I had like a heroine who was like Indiana Jones, but instead of it being like T-Rexes and ancient curses and stuff, it was aliens. So it was a lot of like very generic ideas that weren't too generic for Hollywood and stuff to start doing them later on.
So Spielberg ripped you off for Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, huh?
Yeah, he can have that one. He can have it. Still... Don't worry, Stephen, you don't need to.
Did you come up with the monkey chase?
No. I was all about the ants piling up on each other.
Man, I've forgotten so many details of that film. So mine would have been, because I remember drawing these over and over again, it would have been basically G.I. Joe if shot through the mind of a 10-year-old who's read loads of 2000 ADs that year. So I was constantly like drawing characters who were all part of some sort of either like a good guy side or a bad guy side. But so many of them would have like the head of Rojals from Robusters. Or various like additional features taken from various 2000 AD characters. And I think I have mentioned this before, is a lot of the characters I would draw, because I couldn't draw for a full stop, but I would give loads of characters like chainsaws for hands to avoid having to draw hands, and caterpillar tracks for legs. Similarly, yeah. So it would be like that. It would be like, it would probably be just incredibly violent and far more violent than would be allowed actually on children's television at the time. But
I think when you're a kid, especially, there's something really cool about those like tank treads, like caterpillar treads. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I remember being endlessly fascinated with those.
Yeah. I think it's, but then you learn like, oh, hang on, caterpillar. Also, there's like a line of boots called caterpillar. Okay. Right, okay. I think we also had like a caterpillar branch in town that might have also been an influence on but yeah, beyond the general kid fascination with trucks and heavy machinery in general. Right, enough of this fantasizing. Aaron's the only one who's got the possibility of doing anything with this information. Now it's time for Brian's game. It's a double-barreled game.
Right.
Here we go. I've got two different games because I'm not sure either of them will work. But so I mentioned the Japanese animated films, which came out in 1986. But what of the American and various other co-productions that came out in 1986 in the American market? So I've looked at the numbers. .com because Box Office Mojo is now behind a paywall. It's very frustrating. It's now, if you want to see like the detailed stuff, you have to be an IMDb Pro member.
That's so lame.
It is.
Yeah.
But I'm going to ask you, I'm going to name another animated movie from 1986, and you just have to tell me what you think the US box office was, and then the other player will guess whether they think it's higher or lower, and we'll start with Aaron because his name begins with A.
Okay.
Aaron, GoBots Battle of the Rock Lords, how much do you think that took in 1986 money?
Maybe. So not adjusted for inflation?
Not adjusted for inflation.
Okay. Not that that's going to help me. But maybe.
Oh, hang on. I do apologize. Apparently they are inflation adjusted. So I'll take that back.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm so bad at this kind of thing. Maybe 60,000. No, it's got to be more than that. Let's say, I don't know, 90,000.
Oh, well, I'll give you a start. They're all in the millions, so.
Oh, okay. All right, should I answer again?
Answer again, yes.
Okay, let's say, that's what I was thinking of. I'd say 3 million.
3 million. Do you think that's going to be... Do you think the actual number's higher or lower, Leon?
This is tough.
It is.
I'm going to undercut you and go 2 million.
No, you just have to say higher or lower. You don't have to worry about what...
Oh, actual. Lower.
Lower. You are correct, Leon. That's a point to you. It took in $1.3 million.
Wow.
I think it also tells you how many people saw it. Tickets sold. GoBots. Let me have a look. GoBots. It was the number 167th film of that year. And apparently 360,718 people paid to see it.
Next, not bad.
Next up. This is Leon to guess the value, and then Aaron to guess which way he thinks it actually went. The Care Bears Movie 2, A New Generation.
Oh, the sequel. This is Care Bears. Care Bears was big, right? Or was that my memory of that era?
It was big.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah.
I'm going to go punchy then. These are adjusted for inflation.
Oh, yeah, I should tell you what the top movie was. The very top movie was Top Gun, with a gross of 168 million.
Okay, I'm going to go a solid 10 mil for Care Bears 2.
I'm going to say higher.
What do you say, Leon, on your number?
10.
That's another point to Leon. It took 8.5 million.
That wasn't that far off.
Actually, I'm not sure whether these are inflation or not. It mentions that inflation-adjusted figures are based on ticket sale estimates, but it may be just a general message. But anyway, I've given you the top gun was 168 million, so that gives you a range.
Yeah,
and the very bottom film, Fast Talking, took $1,488.
Wow.
I've never heard of it.
Next up, Aaron. My Little Pony Movie.
I'm going to say 11 million.
Leon, do you think My Little Pony was actually higher or less?
That was massive as well, though, wasn't it?
It was pretty massive.
Well, so what did you say again?
11.
11, I'm going to go higher.
Now, I'm afraid My Little Pony was not as massive as going to see the Care Bears again. The My Little Pony only took 5.9 million. So that's a point to Aaron.
I'm on the board.
Leon, The Great Mouse Detective.
Okay.
We're not selling toys now.
Yeah. I'm going to go 6 million.
Aaron. I'm going to say higher.
That is correct. 23.6 million.
Oh, man.
Because I know Disney wasn't doing too well in the 80s, but I got to assume that they were still...
These fluctuate. That did really well.
That was the first sort of sign of them coming back, I think, right? After, like, Black Cauldron being the low point.
Then
I guess Little Mermaid, obviously, was a big smash.
Little Mermaid's the smash, yeah. Aaron, your turn to guess again. The Transformers movie. Oh, sorry, The Transformers, the movie.
I'm going to say 25 million.
Leon, higher or lower than 25 million for The Transformers, the movie?
I'm going to go lower, but I think it's close, so I'm going to go lower.
You are correct. It is lower, but you're incorrect in that it's close. It took less than My Little Pony, 5.8 million.
What?
I hear so much about Transformers, the movie, being The Transformers, the movie, being like a big deal from the 80s animation, you know.
I guess it was just big on home video, maybe.
It probably was. That's probably it, yeah.
Possibly. Let me just check when it came out. August the 8th, so it's not like it was carrying over into the next year. But
they don't have that excuse.
No. It's not like Beverly Hills Cop, which was like in the top 10 2 years running. And the final one, this is with Leon. It is An American Tale.
Oh, Bible.
Indeed.
Okay, I'm gonna go. Oh, great, the great mouse detective shook me. I'm gonna go 7 million. No. Screw it. 17 million.
This is the year of the mouse.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say higher.
That is correct. 42.8 million.
Whoa. That is even higher than I would have expected.
Yeah, that was the highest rated in terms of gross animated movie in America that year. Number 18, it was between Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, and Police Academy 3, Back in Training.
I knew it was going to be big because that's one of the ones that, like, I'm not really a big fan of Don Bluth, but everybody goes, well, you got to give him American Tale and, like, I don't know, Land Before Time, I guess. But even then, I didn't think it was that big.
No, you don't. You don't have to give him that. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I liked Land Before Time as a kid. I never really liked American Tale much. And I don't think I would have any love for Land Before Time at this point.
Right, that's why I needed the second game, because it's now a draw, 3-3. So the next game is based on the top pirate animated movies on IMDb that have a ranking, have more than 5,000 ratings. Just to remove the strange Russian pirate animation that is occupying the top 10. If you don't, someone's really voting up this series of Russian pirate movies.
It's a whole subgenre.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you two pirate animated pirate movies, and you sort of tell me which one you think is better rated on IMDb. We'll start with Aaron. Do you think My Little Pony 2017 or One Piece, what's the most recent one? I've knowingly not written it down. Let me just go back. One Piece, it's not even the most recent one. One Piece Z. What is better rated, the 2017 My Little Pony movie, which apparently features pirates?
Or I was going to say, how is that a pirate movie?
Or One Piece, I guess, yeah. Z.
Some pirate pony or something. Man, people love that My Little Pony, or they did for around 2017, I guess. No, wait. I think it peaked way earlier than that, because I remember when I moved to LA, I met this guy who turned out to be a brony, and I was a little surprised that he was still a brony even at that point. I'm going to say the One Piece.
That is correct. That is number two. And My Little Pony was number 21.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Leon.
I think the ship had the ship had sailed by that point.
Which of these animated pirate movies has a better rating on IMDb? Is it Pokemon the First Movie or Asterix in Britain?
That was Pokemon a pirate movie.
Don't know, but it has the keyword pirates in it on IMDb.
Alright.
Okay. I'm going to go with Pokemon.
I'm afraid Asterix in Britain is number 12, and Pokemon the First Movie is number 18.
Oh.
Interesting. I wouldn't have expected Asterix to be that. I mean, I know people like it. Wouldn't expect it to be bigger than Pokemon.
There may be like a slither of ratings between them, I think. Asterix in Britain is 7.1 and Pokemon the First Movie is 6.3. I think the thing is, I think if you're an Anglophone movie fan watching Asterix in Britain, you're watching Asterix in Britain because you want to watch Asterix in Britain. I think there's a lot of people who had to watch Pokemon the First Movie who did not want to watch Pokemon the First Movie.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah.
Next up is... back to Aaron. Which of these is the most popular animated pirate movie? Is it Moana or The Little Mermaid?
I think I'm going to say The Little Mermaid.
You should have said Moana. Moana is number 5. Little Mermaid is number 6.
Better than
Moana. Oh, God.
I mean, I guess Moana came out during the IMDb era, so maybe that's skews things a little bit.
We're back to Leon. There's an opening here. So, Leon, which of these is the most popular animated pirate movie of these two? Is it the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, or is it the SpongeBob SquarePants movie Sponge Out of Water?
I'm going to go with the first one.
You are correct. That is number 11, and the other one is number 22. Which for my money is too low. That should be higher.
On the yeah, other. Sponge Out of Water? I thought that was pretty good.
And it's heavily pirate. There's a lot of pirate content in that. Antonio Banderas is having such a good time in that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Aaron, back to you. Which is the more popular of these two? Is it Ice Age, Continental Drift? How does that have pirates in it? Or Shrek the Third?
I'm going to assume Shrek the Third.
I'm afraid you've assumed wrong. Ice Age Continental Drift is at number 17. Shrek the Third is at number 19.
I've never seen any Ice Age movies.
I have never seen...
I saw Shrek 3 and it was bad. I figured Ice Age was probably worse.
Yeah, I've not seen Ice Age and I've not seen Shrek movies. I've gone...
Oh, not even the first one?
Not even the first one.
I mean, at this point, you're fine.
Yeah.
I've seen the first two. I've never seen any of that.
Don't do it.
I just remember those videos that Tim and Eric did about Shrek the Third, where they were constantly going on about how the guy, the director, was absolutely the most perfect choice based on his non-animation background.
I gotta look these up. I love Tim and Eric.
They're doing it very sincerely. They're like, as the co-writer of all these films, he's absolutely the right person to direct Shrek the Third. Next up for Leon is, which of these is the better rated pirate animated movie? Is it Laputa, Castle of the Sky, or is it The Lego Movie?
Usually it feels like there's a recency bias, but right. I'm going to go with Laputa, Castle in the Sky.
You are correct.
Yeah, Lego Movie's pretty good, but I don't think it can be
too. Yeah, I love the Lego Movie.
Laputa is number 1. It is the best animated pirate movie. And Lego Movie is number 3.
What was number 2 again?
Have we had number 2 yet? It was One Piece Movie Z.
Oh, yeah.
Next up for Aaron is... Which is the better one? Is it... Or not better one. What is the best rated one? Is it Tintin? Let me get the full title here. Tintin, The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. That's the Steven Spielberg one. Or is it Star Wars, The Clone Wars?
I think Tintin.
That is correct. Tintin is at number 7, and Star Wars, The Clone Wars is at number 24.
Mm-hmm. As it should be. Get down there.
Next up for Leon Deers, which is the better rated one? Is it Porco Rosso or The Lego Movie 2?
I'm going to go Porco Rosso.
That is correct. Porco Rosso is number 4. The Lego Movie 2 is at number 16.
Always got a bet on Ghibli.
Yeah.
Then we've got for Aaron. Is it? Hang on. Let me make this more distinguished. Is it 2016's Robinson Crusoe, or is
it? What?
Or is it 2002's Peter Pan 2 Return to Neverland?
Wait, they made a Robinson Crusoe movie in 2016?
Yeah, let me
is
have
it
a
based
look.
Based on that like French, maybe French Canadian animated series from the 90s?
Directors are Vincent Castellute, Ben Stassen, and the writing is Dominic Paris. So
sounds pretty French. I think it's probably the same guys.
It looks like it's had an English dub. Yeah, there's two sets of voice acting credits here.
Wow, I had no idea. I used to watch Robinson Crusoe on Teletoon in Canada. I had no idea it was anything more than a distant memory.
I don't know whether it is that Robinson Crusoe or whether it's another Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah.
But it's definitely...
Oh, wait, no, never mind. I was getting the names mixed up. Yeah, the cartoon I was thinking of was Robinson Sucro. It was like
yes,
a parody.
I know that. Yes.
Yeah.
It's not that.
Okay. Right. So what was the other option?
Peter Pan 2, Return to Neverland.
I'm going to say Peter Pan 2.
That is correct. That is number 25 out of 26, whereas Robinson Crusoe is number 26 out of 26. Okay. Then we've
got... I wish there was a Robinson Sucro movie.
Leon, The Pagemaster or Asterix in America?
I'm going Asterix this time.
Well, you should have gone Pagemaster. Pagemaster was number 20. Asterix in America was number 23.
I can't win with Asterix.
Talking of Asterix, Aaron, which is the more better rated animated pirate movie? Is it Asterix and Cleopatra or is it Treasure Planet?
I'd say Asterix and Cleopatra.
No, it's Treasure Planet, but they're very close. Treasure Planet is number 9. Asterix and Cleopatra is number 10.
Okay. I'm surprised Treasure Planet is that high.
It's currently a draw, so Leon, your final one could send you over into the winning category, or we'll have to do the final tiebreaker one. So
the third game.
No, I've got two of these battles left, so there's one left over. Okay. Leon, The Pirates, Band of Misfits, or Pirates in an Adventure with Scientists, as it's called over here.
Oh, I thought those were the two options.
No. They renamed it because they thought Americans would not want to go and see a movie with the word scientists in the title.
Right. Yeah, probably true if it's yours taught us anything.
Or Sinbad, Legend of the Seven Seas.
I feel like Sinbad's going to screw me, but I'm going to go with Pirates.
You are correct. You are the winner. Pirates was number 13. Sinbad was number 15.
I'm just happy to hear that answer, because that Pirates movie was fun and Sinbad looked lame.
I'd forgotten Sinbad existed.
Exactly.
Whereas
that's the DreamWorks one, right?
It is, yeah. Brad Pitt, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Joseph Fiennes, Michelle Pfeiffer. To be honest, I've forgotten Joseph Fiennes existed until I read
that. That movie was not very appetizing, but the Pirates one's fun.
Yeah, Pirates is good.
Yeah, it's a cracking movie. That is it. Thanks for joining me on this pirate-filled podcast. Before we go, let's get your plugs in. Aaron?
Check out my cartoons. They're on YouTube, YouTube.com/AaronLong1, and I'm on Twitter at AALong64.
Leon.
You can find me on Twitter at Leon Everett, and I am a co-host on a podcast about comic books, and that is on your favorite podcatcher, Ace Comicals. Like Ace Chemicals, but comicals.
And you can listen to this podcast on you're also on your favorite podcatchers, but... the other podcast I do with Dwayne and Niall, Let's Go. You can also watch on YouTube at Let's Go JoJo Show is the channel name, where whenever we record it, we also try and stream the video of us recording it, except in the instances when I'm coughing too much and they've had to do it without me and they don't have the code to stream it themselves. but yes, I've my cough seems to have died down a lot, so it should be back in rotation when you hear this podcast, doing that video stuff, so you can see all our beards. Even Niall's got his camera on now, so we don't have to use a picture of Lupin wearing a fake beard for him. otherwise, we'll be back in about a fortnight's time or thereabouts with another episode of The Anime That Didn't Make Us with me and Gary and a guest. So stay tuned and keep on listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Your life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain.